Yeah, thank you again for the presentations. I will just set my timer so we don't lose track of time. We will have a 30-minute kind of discussion on the panel now, and then I would love to open up for questions that you might have and want to ask our panelists. Yeah, I'm really happy to open the discussion with you, and I would really like to particularly kind of focus on the role of art, because we've had in your presentations kind of like a focus on three art practices, really the kind of like model or the model cinema, the active models. Then, of course, we've heard about art and art making, the kind of like organizing principles in avant-garde art. And then we've heard and about poetry, and kind of like the use of poetry. So these kinds of like three practices for me are really kind of like lead to the topic of the role of art in the cosmic themes. And especially I want to kind of like start the conversation with this connection between the imagination and the implementation. And so maybe, yeah, Svetlana, we can start with you, because you said in your presentation, and I quote, according to Gorsky, art is a specific form of a dream of a new, expanded, and eternal body. So I'm interested kind of like in the use of art as a tool or as a method to imagine the eternal body. Maybe you can comment on that.
There were several poems by Zabolotsky which were kind of congruent with the theory of Gorsky, and which I didn't just have time to quote here and to speak about. One of them was «Вопросы к морю», so the questions to the sea. And speaking about those shapes of thoughts, that's where Zabolotsky, in a poetic manner, reflects that idea of Gorsky. So that the human transforms his own feelings and thoughts by becoming a part of water, literally a part of the sea. And that's how he transforms his essence, particularly that of the sexuality. So.
Yeah, this kind of, I'm really interested in this literal transformation of the material body, or just the kind of like space of imagination, especially when it comes to poetry. Was that really kind of thought as an implementation of this imagined space of transformation, or was it a kind of like literal tool to find strategies to transform the material body?
Well, with poetry, you know, you have to deal with a very close analysis of the text. So this is a matter of the poet, basically transformation of his thoughts to the reader, to the one who is on the other end. So you have to deal with a very close analysis of textual matter. So that's why I'm addressing everyone, because these poems are translated, and particularly the questions to the sea, they were translated into the English. And another one that I can think about here was the shapes of the dream, figuры сна. That's where, in a poetic manner, again, in an artistic manner, Zabolotsky presents his thought about, you know, kind of transfiguration of the human essence into something else, something other than the human himself.
Yeah, Robert, in the same kind of sense, the form of modeling was shown as a kind of like material production that these artists or film cinematographers used to show these possibilities that technically or kind of like were not reached in the kind of like technological development at the time. So my question to you is also kind of like targeted towards this materiality. We talked just about this kind of like possibility and imagination, but really the material existence of these models that you described seems to be in alignment with the aim to make maybe the material body emotional, or bring the material body into space, or kind of like transform the material body with speed. So maybe you can talk a little bit about the importance of the material existence of those models.
Thank you for the question. I think that the central problem throughout Soviet aesthetics in the 1920s into the 1930s is how to think the thing, the material object, together with the idea. And you see on the part of most Bolshevik ideologists, including Stalin in what I quoted, and Kaganovich, really having trouble recognizing ideas in objects. And this has been the question that's animated my study of socialist realism, how this doctrine, or how these works which get gathered together under socialist realism materialize ideas, and how they produce ideas out of their own matter. And I think the best account of that really comes from Čužák. It's very confusing, but he goes through this dialectical analysis of thing and idea, and he comes to the conclusion that the idea is the thing in the idea. It is its material incarnation, or its material realization. That is the idea. There is no idea outside. It's a very materialist account. But it's a very unstable account. And again, it wasn't very popular among the ideological authorities. But it remains the key question through the works in the late 20s of the Bakhtin circle, for example. And I found that, personally, I find intellectually most satisfying the account by Pavel Medvedev in his book, The Formal Method in Literary Scholarship, Formalny Metod v Literaturoведении, where he goes through a quite elaborate analysis of the material base and the superstructure, and how the superstructure itself has a material base. Ideas exist only in their material form and have to be transfigured or worked upon in the material form. And so this, for me, leads to the focus on modeling. I'm not interested in claiming that everything is a model. I'm not only interested in models, but the models do provide a very clear focus of how ideas become materialized into objects, and how those objects then can produce ideas. And I think that the importance, or the just proliferation of these models in the films of the 1930s, is because they're interested in this process, precisely. They're interested in seeing how, one of the films, a young person learns to produce something new, something that's never existed before. And they're interested in how a scientist works through obvious contradictions. So I would take your question, I feel like that was what I was talking about. I would turn it to a question for Maria, because that's what I'm interested in there. We have this stoff, this вещество, throughout all of these thinkers. But I feel the difference comes in when they think the primal matter together with technology, together with its transformation, through labor, its transformation through machines. And I would think that Arvatov's resolution of this question is very different from Platonov's resolution of this question, for example. So I was interested in hearing you integrate possibly the question of technology in with the question of matter.
Thank you for the question. No, I never said they are the same. I didn't have time to elaborate on that, but I mentioned the two different approaches to this Bogdanovian idea of organization. One would be, strictly speaking, productivist, and Arvatov would be exemplary of that approach, which is roughly brings together this organizational ontology and a kind of technicist, especially in some articles of, not in Art and Production, but in other articles of Arvatov, he insists on, technicist sort of, it's technicist interpretation of Marxism, the transformation of productive forces, collectivization of labor will immediately, by technological means, will immediately bring communism. So just automatically, in some of his, and he was criticized for that if you collectivize art production, if you bring machines, and if artists will start to use machines and advanced technology, it does not necessarily bring communist relations into the art, and it doesn't mean that art immediately becomes communist. So, and this is the position of Arvatov, which is more productivist interpretation of organization and of production. But of course, in Platonov, on aesthetic level, it's reorganization of perception, which would be more important for him. And I think we can link him with more directly with Bogdanov's aesthetical theory, because for Bogdanov, aesthetics, the task of aesthetics is the reorganization of perception. So it's much modest than, for instance, the task of the proletariat, who actually reorganizes production and material infrastructures. And Tarabukin, who wrote on also on this reorganization of perception by means of painting, would be close, and maybe Zygavertov. So you can see these two lines, you know, within this framework. But of course, further philosophical elaboration of this question in Platonov goes further with this notion of вещество, but I think we have to also distinguish it from his theory of what art should do. This is rather goes beyond the task of art, when he talks about this вещество, and so it just to clarify my position on that. So it's multiple, it's very interesting, diverse discussion, actually. And
I'm really interested in this kind of like circularity that maybe all three of you described. Robert, you said through the models, hands teach heads, and then teach hands. So there is, and in this kind of like reflective mode of that you described in kind of like collecting the particles and then kind of like making the brick in a red color, understanding red, and therefore there is this kind of like circularity just by this kind of like organizing principles. So my question of that type of circularity or kind of like self-organizing flow that you also talked about is really the kind of step from the model to the object, or from the object to reality, and then reality to the model, and so on. Is that kind of, do I understand that right, that this circularity is a topic?
Well, if I could start to respond, I wouldn't call it reflective. My point is precisely the opposite, that this is a pragmatic process. It's a praxis, and progress, in this case, for the Soviets, can only come by working through. This is a very important verb in my own presentation, in some of the quotations, the working through. And the theoretical, the theorists, the pure theorists, are always ridiculed. They're just writing books. It's all theory. Show us, in fact, how it's going to work. And very often that means showing in a model. There's another film, which I didn't mention. It's a difficult film to write about. It's called Zaklyuchennye, The Convicts, and it's the screen version of a famous play about the White Sea, Baltic Sea Canal, about the use of slave convict labor on the canal. And there are two engineers there, one, and they're resisting the camp leadership who want these engineers to help build the canal. One of them produces a big book about how to build a canal, and the other makes a scale model, and he shows the camp leader, look, this is how these schluze, these locks, are going to work. And this convinces the other one to get rid of his gray theory, his pure theory, which is just words. Or in Cosmic Voyage, there's a rival rocket scientist to our friend Siddich, who is sending a real rocket with real people, and this other one is sending animals. And he sends one rocket up, and the hare, or rabbit, Korolik, comes back dead. And he says, look, you can't use this rocket because this rabbit went up and he's dead. And this scientist says, well, I'm not a rabbit, I can go. He believes that he has worked through these problems in his own rocket. He doesn't need the theory to prove it. So it is circular, but it's an intense circularity within which there is no possibility of an exterior point of view. All of the arguments, whether they be of the specialists or the West or history or military might, are irrelevant. This is happening. This is fact. And this is a noble Marxist idea, of praxis, of the dialectics of praxis. So it's a very compelling, I think it was a very compelling stance at the time. And it's one that remains attractive in certain ways, but obviously needs a certain correction if we're going to proceed with this notion of Marxist praxis, I think, in these cases.
Yeah, I completely agree with what have been said. I would just add to that this fusion of science, positivism, and Marxism actually happens here through the notion of praxis. Also in Bogdanov, who rereads even value theory throughout of Capital in this famous appreciation and accent on use value, which is for him becomes also a kind of very pragmatist reading of the the transformations of value and which take shape of different forms. So everything goes back to the use value, to the utilitarian appeal of labor to these attributes of objects. This becomes a very metaphysical category for Bogdanov, and this metaphysical reading of capital and use value through practice of labor to shape and reshape the attributes and to shape these objects. So it becomes central, and this is the marks of Bogdanov. So it's nothing more than that. Plus a historization of experience and historization of this process of of organization, which is something interesting because in empiricist philosophy or elsewhere you have that perception is just pre-given attributes of subject to perceive, and in Bogdanov he deconstructs and he just adds to that the historical again means of praxis. So the praxis, yeah, is the key in this fusion of positivism, empiricism, and Marxism. And with regards to circularity, I would say at least in Bogdanov is kind of open-ended process, historically changing, which depends on different historical preconditions. And of course, potentially it could take shape of classless society, but otherwise it could take shape of other different forms. And it's endless process of self-organizing, universal process, which has the social dimension and has molecular, biological, cosmic dimensions. And it's rather sort of horizontal, unlimited, not, it doesn't repeat itself in a circular way.
And if I can just add to that, so art, you began by asking about art, but art itself then becomes folded into this notion of praxis. It is part of a praxis, and it's distinct from production, but it's inseparable from production. And this is where Medvedev comes in, really. I can produce an image of iron, of something being built from iron. It isn't iron, but it does change iron. It changes our perception of iron. It changes the functioning of iron in our world, in our economy. And the moment that I'm talking about, the moment of the shift from the avant-garde to socialist realism, which Stalin introduced with this famous phrase of writers as engineers of human souls, which is a phrase that I'm playing off of when I call art or film a soul machine. This is the shift from thinking about matter and technology in art, thinking of art as involved in the praxis, in a technological praxis, to thinking of art also as being involved in the praxis, the emotional praxis, the human praxis of relating to the world, of organizing the world, perceiving the world, the recognition that someone like Virtov, for example, might have been ignoring the emotional needs of someone, and so there's of the people involved in building socialism. And so there's really an attempt to fold psychology into this all-encompassing account of practice. And art is important as a mediating, remains important as this place where matter, ideas, emotions come into contact, reshape each other, and it is believed that if we can reshape the way that people feel, if this engineer, the second engineer in the film, the convicts, believes that it's possible to produce this kind of canal, then the material realization can proceed from that. But these things go together and have to be addressed together within this circular praxis.
When it comes to poetry and language, you don't have that kind of like material object that kind of like can show a model or can kind of like be produced out of a collection of several entities and so on. But is there still that kind of like the same step to some sort of realization from this immaterial kind of art. Mm-hmm.
Well, in the case with Zabolotsky, first of all, he did not write. He did not create any kind of philosophy per se. There was nothing written by him as a philosophical treatise, so to say. It was only his longer poems, or maybe shorter poems, with philosophical content. And continuing what was said by Robert about the engineers of soul, well, yes, Zabolotsky was not the perfect engineer of the perfect new communist souls, of course. There was no propagation of the communist ideas. There was something else. There was something which was very close to the rolling down into the idealism, which was totally unacceptable in the beginning of the 1930s, especially after the first Congress of the Soviet writers in 1934 took place, where the older writers were converted, so to say, into these engineers, who were given good salaries, dachas, etc., in exchange for being good writers, promoting socialism and communism. In case of Zabolotsky, there was nothing like this. He was constantly thinking about something else, converting these mythological ideas of his into, say, object by blowing, as I already quoted him, his own spirit out through that pipe, and the words would become objects, popping up as those little objects. So it has nothing to do with the ideas of communism and Marxism. Although, and of course, it was either Marxism and communism or idealism. There was nothing else. There should be nothing else, according to the philosophers of Marxism-Leninism. So, of course, in their vision, he was an idealist, not a proper Marxist, and for that he had to be punished. Speaking about his triumph of agriculture, there was another poem by another famous Russian poet, Nikolai Kluyev, Pogorelchina, the burnt land, which in my book I'm writing about as well as an opposition to the triumph of agriculture by Zabolotsky. Zabolotsky was able to publish it in 1933, and that caused a huge persecution from the authorities and ultimately his imprisonment and exile. And the same happened to Kluyev. He said that he was burnt by his Pogorelchina, by his burnt land, like protopop Аввакум on his own stake. Я сгорел на своей Погорельщине, как протопоп Аввакум на костре. I'm quoting, but not very precisely. So Zabolotsky was to show the triumph of collectivization, what had to do that. The collectivization was going on in 1934 already, but it was not glorious, far from being glorious, in fact, especially in the south of Russia, in the Ukraine, where the victims were numerous, millions already, right? So all these writers and poets with their business trips, so to say, they had to show, like Pasternak and others, they had to show what was going on. There's something good, excellent, but in fact, it was a total collapse and failure. So that's how the philosophy of Zabolotsky was developing through his poetry particularly. Now, I was also going to just maybe comment on Robert's words about that Кролики, rabbits, and the aviation, et cetera, et cetera. There was an idea of transforming beautiful, kind of innovative thoughts into the reality. Do you know anything about the tragedy which happened with that balloon, which was called, since you're in aviation kind of research, of the 30s, in 1934 there was a Osoveahim balloon. Did you hear about that? And if yes, what can you say about it? I mean, there were three scientists who wanted to fly in that hot balloon up in the atmosphere, and that happened in 1932 during the time of the one of the parties' congress, and they were so sure in their ideas to be perfect, have a happy ending, that they flew up in the atmosphere and that they literally blew and went down dead. And that was within one day and had a tremendous effect on the society as far as I know.
I can say something about that, as a matter of fact. Soviet history is full of aviation catastrophes. There was this one in 34. In 35, the big plane Maxim Gorky crashed, killing, 50 people about. 1938, Chkalov dies in an accident. 1939, one of the great female aviators, Polina Sipienko, dies in an aviation accident. It's a very interesting kind of series. And they were huge national tragedies, and including the one in 1934. I know a diary entry in Chukovsky where he writes about this. There was also a young girl, Nina Lugavskaya, who wrote a diary that's a fascinating record of the 1930s, and she writes extensively about this, despite the fact that her own father was repressed. He was an old socialist revolutionary, or social revolutionary, and had been in prison. Despite the fact that she herself was very angry about things, she's involved in these public narratives of aviation. And that's where I disagree with you about, even about Zabalotsky, not that I know him that well, but there are practical places where the Stalinist project becomes acceptable even to people like Zabalotsky, who are anti-modern, anti-technology. For example, Michurin, his great poem about Michurin, the botanist experimenting with fruits. This is another what you in German and Russian you could call praktik. Don't have a good word, practitioner, who disproves all of the theories, those elaborate theories of all those Darwins and other people. You know, they don't work with actual fruit. And here we have the fruit of the experiments proving the legitimacy of the premises on which the experiments are based. And so he does participate in some of these nationwide narratives, including that of Michurin. He has one on Sidov, I think, the one of the sailors. And
especially as his father, was an agronomist.
Yeah, and so writing, you know, one could dispute whether writing poetry is or is not a material practice. Language is the stuff of ideology, no less than technology is the stuff of ideology. And working on language for Zabalotsky, I think, had a certain, there was an analogy between what Michurin could be doing with botany, with horticulture, and what he could be doing with words, with concepts, with images.
Mm-hmm. I would love to open the panel up to the audience. If you have questions, please raise your hands. And we have microphones, so before you ask the question, please wait for the microphone. Otherwise, our translators cannot translate. Here in the first row.
Thank you. I have two questions. First, to Maria, expert on Bogdanov. One of the principles of his dictology was the principle of contra-differentiatia, the overcoming of any differences, because he thought differences weaken the organism, weaken the society, everything, so they have to be overcome. For example, by mutual blood transformation, this will overcome the differences between persons, even between men and women. The aim is a kind of unification, and at the end, and I think Bogdanov is thinking about an end, is the single сверх человечество, the superhumanity. So does the principle of contradifferentiatia apply to art? This is my question to Maria, and if we allow another question to Svetlana. The influence of Tsiolkovsky's philosophy of the besouled atom is obvious, and they even on Zabalotsky, they even corresponded, they knew each other. But I wonder, could you say more about the sources of this panpsychism and metempsychosis, if it's understandable, the wandering of the soul, or the wandering of the besouled atom? Panpsychism was very popular at that time in Russia, in Russian philosophy. There was Kozlov, Lapatin, Lorsky. There was also translated the works by Karl Duprel and the famous works by Ernst Haeckel. And by the way, Fyodorov fiercely opposed the idea of a besouled atom wandering from one incarnation to another. He fiercely opposed Buddhism, whereas Tsiolkovsky wrote a tract called Nirvana. So I don't see any influence of Fyodorov. But could you say more about the sources of this? Maybe it's also an influence of theosophy. We also encounter the idea of the wandering atom, the besouled atom, panpsychism in theosophy. And we know that theosophical ideas deeply influenced the cosmic philosophy of Tsiolkovsky. Kaluga at that time was the center of Russian theosophy. So this is the question to Svetlana. Thank you.
Thank you for your question. This counter-differentiation, which is actually comes from a philosopher, from German philosopher Avenarius, as far as I know. I read, first of all, I read this, if philosophically and politically, you can frame this idea of rationalization, which is elimination of differences and potential, so the theory of organization in Bogdanov, I didn't have time to mention that, but of course, potentially, he talks about communist society as elimination of differences, different points of views on social level. So classless society for him is this homogeneous, hyper-rational kind of field or environment where class, ethnical, religious, whatever, national differences just eliminated, abolished. And this perfectly organized, harmonious society is reached. So you can read it in many different ways. You can also read it through discussion on organization and spontaneity, which goes back to Lenin and his idea of the party. And if you read political texts of Bogdanov on that, is clearly the idea of organization also has this political connotations and illumination of, and the belief in rationalism and belief in necessity to guide disorganized, spontaneously formed alliances of workers and peasants on political level, you can say, this is the same tradition which links Bogdanov and Lenin, at least in the early dialogue within the Bolsheviks party. But I wouldn't say this is very close to the superhumanity, new Soviet man. I think because at the beginning of my talk I said that my idea is to go a little bit beyond of these notions, the new Soviet man, the superhuman. I think even if you read some of other philosophical texts of Bogdanov, it is very paradoxical theory which says that illumination of differences for him means much more complex and richer discussion between different groups. And he actually battles with this theory, very positivistic theory. He battles against already Stalinized Marxist circles in, for instance, in 1927. He had a very interesting debates in Academy for Red Professors, where he says that precisely when you illuminate these differences, you can have proper discussion about many issues. But otherwise, you will always find the wall because bourgeoisie and proletariat cannot ever reach any consensus because it's by the definition, one has to disappear or dismantle itself through the other, and the proletarian culture should rise. So he saw that this illumination of differences will bring consensual mode of thinking, consensual kind of assembly-like discussion style within the party. So I would say it's very peculiar and very interesting and less Stalinized, because he argued against Stalinism all the time. And in relation to literature, very, very briefly, literature to art, I think this illumination of differences, if we read it at least in these two aspects, like organization and spontaneity debate, then of course in constructivist and productivist art movements, the illumination of the spontaneity of the chaotically formed, art or social processes, that's what they discuss and battle. An organization of perception for Werther, for Platonov, for many others is precisely the articulation of in a proper form the feelings and thoughts of proletariat and peasants who otherwise lack this kind of organization. On the other level is also collectivization of art and literature would be linked to bringing everything to a kind of collectivized form. And in Platonov, there is an article, Factory of Literature, where he discusses a method of literature as to be based on polufabrikat, which is semi-finished product, which you find on the streets. So it's pieces of language and pieces of words, which writer should collect directly from the people, and then artistically elaborate them and to make a kind of artistic montage of that. But he says this is like 100% life. You do not invent anything, so.
Maria, I want to kind of maybe get one more question from the audience in, but thank you for this answer. Can I open for just one more question? In the second row.
I'd like to take up the issue of models and socialist realism and thank Robert for an absolutely brilliant paper full of gorgeous films I didn't know, but obviously so futuristic and looking forward to the 60s. What interested me was like that tiny moment when you showed the model of the Palace of Culture, because I know about the arguments for the choosing of the style of the Palace of Culture. And, so it became much more neoclassical and all the avant-garde people were very shocked. And what is interesting for me is that the erection of a very large-scale model of the Palace of Culture becomes the kind of centerpiece of the Palace of the Palace of the Soviets, the Soviet Pavilion at the Paris World Fair. What I wanted to ask you was that obviously before models of aeroplanes, models are architectural. There's a wonderful article about miniaturization which compares the kind of Platonic marble model with the decaying cork model in the 18th century. And what is very weird, of course, is that this is precisely the time when Speer is making models of the Third Reich as ruins in 2000 years, the marble cork scenarios to do with it. So what I wanted to ask you was, in as much as this Soviet Palace of the Soviets is surrounded not only in its installation in the 37 Pavilion with extremely militaristic and negative slogans by Stalin, but also the very, very worst and most, if you want to use the word kitsch, types of really bad, painterly socialist realism, completely the opposite of the kind of films you were showing, is there a kind of, can one trace a kind of regression into what one could call possibly bad socialist realism by the reversion of the model from the aviation model and the moving model and the speed and film-connected model back to the neoclassical architectural model with all that might herald in terms of a reversal?
Robert, can we just... wanted to take the time, reduce the answer to 2 minutes or so.
Yeah.
Thank you for the question. It's not only very perceptive about my presentation, but well informed, I think, about models generally. You know, I have got pretty far into the history of scale models, and they go back to ancient Egypt, you know, ancient Babylon, and through all walks of life. Architectural models in Russia go back at least to the 18th century. And then there's the whole Third Reich aspect. So I just leave that alone. I don't know enough about it to speak intelligently about it. I'm really focused on the Soviet case and really on the 1930s. And there is, of course, what Chuzhak or what my friends Gretzer and Bibikov would see as a regression to a dead model, a replica. In the late 30s, what becomes exhibition culture the world over, and the 1937 pavilion in Paris, the 1939 pavilion in New York, are full of models of all sorts. Some of them, however, are really, really interesting working models, as are some of the paintings. I can't allow you to say that the paintings are only the worst kitsch type of socialist realism. We have major socialist realist paintings there, Daneka and everything. But let me just, for one second, that model of the Palace of the Soviets. The Palace of the Soviets existed only as models. It was never built in full scale. And yet it existed in many people's imagination. There's one emigre, Boris Shiryaev, who was in exile in the 30s, and then he left the Soviet Union when the war started. He hadn't been in Moscow for 15 years. He gets to Italy and he says, Rome is the opposite of Moscow because Rome is low in the middle with all these excavations and high in the outskirts, whereas Moscow is so high in the middle with the Palace of Soviets standing there so proudly, and it goes low in the outskirts. So in his mind, it was built. But those models not only worked in people's imagination to produce this image of Moscow, they were actually used experimentally to test whether what sort of materials the building had to be built out of in wind tunnels and things like that. So there's a big discourse throughout the construction of the Palace of Soviets about how the model relates to the full-size thing. And so it remains, if not an actual, at least a potential site of experimentation, critique, a transformation of practice, etc.
Yeah, thank you very much for this very intense and rich panel. Thank you for the questions, and I hope that we can kind of continue throughout the day this conversation. Thank you very much.